When the children of Israel came out of Egypt, God gave them a command. It was a very simple command, but it is found in the book of Exodus, chapter 12. Now, in Exodus chapter 12, we have the first Passover. This was a Passover under the guidance of Moses. I didn't say under the instructions of Moses, because God gave Moses the instructions, and Moses told the people how to keep the Passover. So this is the first Passover. On this Passover, they had the blood on the doorpost and on the lintel, and the death angel passed over them. But God gave them a command, and it is found in Exodus chapter 12, verse 15. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. We're here on the first day of unleavened bread. After today, we have 6 more days that we're going to be eating unleavened bread until the last day of unleavened bread, which is Friday. And so we won't be able to eat any unleavened bread till Friday afternoon or Friday evening ends. So for 7 days, we're going to eat unleavened bread. We're going to follow this command right here in verse 15. On the first day, you shall have removed, as it should say, leaven from your houses. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And on the first day there shall be a holy convocation, shall do no manner of work. So we're here today, and if this were a regular weekly day, a weekly Sabbath, annual Sabbath, we wouldn't be doing any work. And more so now because it falls on the Sabbath. So God told them, on the beginning of my days of unleavened bread, no bread shall be eaten, you shall eat unleavened bread. And this is going to go on for 7 days. Until the last day of unleavened bread. Why was this command given? Verse 39. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt. For it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. Now the way the children of Israel leavened their bread was very interesting. They used what was called sourdough, and you would take water and flour, sometimes they added a little sugar to it, and you would make a paste, and you would set it off to the side on a counter somewhere. And there's yeast everywhere, brethren. The yeast spores would fall from the air onto this container of this, well, I was going to say, it's not sourdough yet, but onto this container of flour and water. And because it was usually warmed up a little bit, perfect environment for growing things, the yeast, which is a microscopic little, some say it's a plant, some say it's an animal, depending on what your authority is in the biological world, but this little organism would grow, and it breathes out carbon dioxide. So the carbon dioxide, this air that it breathes out, it respirates out, fluffs up the dough by providing the carbon dioxide. And so this makes the bread, the starter, full of bubbles. So it would usually be bubbling. It doesn't look very good when you're looking at it because it's bubbling and doing all of this. But what they would do is they would make a lump of flour with water. And bread is simply water and flour. It's sort of like soap. And what do I mean by that? Soap. There's all different kinds of soap, but all of your soap is the same. They take a soap product, and they add perfumes to it, and they add coloring to it, but the soap is all the same. It's the same thing. Well, bread is all the same, except you add sugar to it, or you add cinnamon to it, or you add cheese to it, or whatever you want to add to it. So it's flour and water, sometimes a little bit of sugar. So it takes part of this fermenting dough, sourdough, because it turns sour, and they would add a little lump of it to the regular flour dough, and that would leaven it up. You've heard a little leaven leavens a whole lump. That's how they made their bread. And so the children of Israel didn't have time to do all this. So when they left Egypt, they ate their bread unleavened. That's why it says, you know, they were in a hurry to leave Egypt, and they didn't have time to go through this whole process. Some of this, by the way, a little trivia here, some of the sourdough, you know, you take this and you put it into the dough mixture over here, And you can take a little bit of this dough out and set it aside, and it becomes sour, and you make bread from that. Some people claim that there's sourdough bread that's been made from starter that's 50 years ago. They just keep making it and making it and making it and making it. A little trivia there. But the thing is, yeast is everywhere. Yeast is everywhere. Now, question. Why do we eat unleavened bread during the Feast of Unleavened Bread? Well, the reason is, it's given here as a command. That's one of the reasons. What does it symbolize when we eat unleavened bread? We're here on the first day of unleavened bread. Those are good questions to ask. And why should we not eat any leavened bread during this feast? Well, today we're going to answer those questions and several others as they relate to unleavened bread and why we do the things that we do. Now, the first thing is, first point, is let's look at the history of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Let's look at the history. Leviticus 23. Let's go to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23 is called the Holy Day chapter for good reason. It contains all the feasts of the Lord. Now, we have annual Sabbaths. There are seven of them. First day of unleavened bread, last day of unleavened bread, Pentecost, atonement, trumpets, first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, last great day, seven. But there's more than seven, and they're feasts. But Passover is also a feast day, although it's not a Sabbath. So the Passover is included in here also. Let's go to Leviticus 23, verse 4. These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. Verse number 6. And on the 15th day of the same moon as the 14th day of the Passover, on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. Verse 8, the last part. The seventh day shall be a holy convocation to you. You shall do no customary work. So from the 15th through the 21st, we have the days of unleavened bread. And it said here that we were supposed to eat unleavened bread. You must eat unleavened bread in verse 6 and do no work during the first day and the last day of these days, the holy days. So God commanded all people everywhere to eat unleavened bread during these days. You know, if you're keeping the feast, obviously. Now let's look at Luke 20. Let's look at Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2. Now Luke chapter 2 is an interesting story. It is a story about Jesus Christ. Did Jesus Christ keep the days of unleavened bread, the Passover? Leviticus chapter 2, if you look at the chronologies in Luke chapter 2, if you look at the chronologies, Jesus is somewhere between 7 years old and maybe 12 years old. Young child. First grader, second grader, something like that. Luke chapter 2, verse 41. His parents, this is Jesus' parents, Mary and Joseph, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the Feast of the Passover. So at the Passover, they journeyed from Bethlehem, which was 20 or 30 miles from Jerusalem, and they went to the feast in the temple area, and they kept the feast. So Jesus, as a child, went with them. Verse 42, it actually gives you the age here. When he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. When they had finished the days, Passover and the days of unleavened bread, he kept them all when he was 12 years old, as was his custom. So Jesus' custom was to keep the days of unleavened bread and to journey with his parents to Jerusalem to keep them there at the temple, because the temple was the center of religious life for people at that time. The boy, verse 43, when they had finished the days as they returned, the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it. Now, this tells us a couple of things. It tells us, first of all, that Jesus was with a large party. There was lots of relatives. There was uncles, there was aunts, there was cousins. Now, think of a small 12, 10-year-old boy. He's with all of his cousins. He's with his uncles. They're traveling back. So it's a big group, and it also means that Jesus was, Jesus did not get into trouble. He you know, wasn't, their parents weren't worried that he was going to go off and drown in a lake, or that he was going to fall off a cliff, or that he was going to run off somewhere. So Jesus was a well-mannered child here, and so well-mannered that the parents, he's with some of the relatives. We don't have to worry about him. I was talking to Jay Hensley the other day, and we both agreed that the best age for a boy is about 11 to 12. Because you're old enough to get around, and you haven't discovered girls yet. So it's all just fun and doing whatever you want. Jesus was at this age, at 12. He was old enough where he was able to walk around, wise enough not to get into trouble, and had lots of relatives, cousins, and friends to associate with. And he was gone for several days before they realized, hey, where is Jesus, our son? So you know the story. They went back and found him discussing in the temple some of the questions that the scholars were asking him. But the point of all of this is that Jesus, as his custom was, at age 12, had already been keeping the feast days since he was a child. You would expect God, the Father, when he was picking the parents for Jesus, to pick parents that would give him the religious training that he needed and ensure that he was able to do what needed to be done. And so Joseph and Mary were parents that kept the feast. And as a result, Jesus, because he was subject to them, kept the feast with them. So in the history of the days of unleavened bread, we see that Jesus kept the feast days, kept the days of mentioned in the Passover. Let's go to Matthew 26. What happened when Jesus got older? Matthew 26. In Matthew 26. And in verse 17. And there's a slight mistranslation here on verse 17. It says, "Now on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying to him, 'Where do you want us to prepare the Passover?'" That doesn't make sense, because if it's the first day of Unleavened Bread, that's today. So the disciples are coming on the first day of Unleavened Bread asking Jesus, "Where do we prepare the Passover?" Well, wait a minute, the Passover was yesterday or 2 days ago by sundowns. So really what's happened is the translators have messed up here. Mine has little highlighted or italicized words that were added. If you read it without the italicized words, it makes perfect sense. Now, on the first of the unleavens, as it should read, why does it say now on the first of the unleavens? The Jews were so righteous that they wanted to do God better than what God had said. So they unleavened several days before the feast started. So by the 13th and the 14th, the countryside was unleavened. The Jews call these the days of the unleavens. So on the first day of the unleavens, which was probably around the 13th, as the sun is setting on the 14th later on, the disciples come to Jesus saying, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" And he said, "You're going to see a certain man. He's going to have a room prepared. Ask him and he'll show you an upper room prepared." They ate on the floor. This was in the east. They ate on the floor, so there would be cushions and tables for them to, you know, set the food on and all that. But everything was prepared. The point is this: was Jesus keeping the Passover when he was an adult in days of unleavened bread? Certainly was. It says right here he was. Disciples came to him. A couple of things about this. This was a domestic-centered Passover, because Jesus and his disciples prepared it themselves. They didn't go to the temple to get a lamb slaughtered by the priest, which some of the other people were doing. The Passover sacrifice is the only sacrifice that is killed by the householder. All the other sacrifices were commanded to be killed at the temple. You and I, if we were keeping the Passover, would have killed our own little lamb. There's a story there. I think you can figure out what it is. But Jesus and his disciples kept the Passover and obviously the days of unleavened bread. Let's go to Acts chapter 12. How about after Jesus had died, gone to heaven, you know, everything had been nailed to the cross, and everything that was changed supposedly had been changed. What happens in Acts chapter 12? Verse 1. "Now about this time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some of the church. Then he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And because he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to seize Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. So Peter was keeping the days of unleavened bread when he was accosted and thrown into prison. So when he had arrested him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after the Passover. So the King James says after Easter. It's a mistranslation. The word for Easter there is Pasqua, which is a Greek word for Passover. So this was after the Passover, so he was keeping the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, the early church was. Let's set up another scenario, forward about four or five pages, in Acts chapter 18. In Acts chapter 18, reading in verse 1, it says, after these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. Now, Paul is the one that established the church at Corinth. You remember in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, we read about the Corinthian church. Paul is the one that raised that church up. He was the one that ordained the elders in it. He's the one that started it. And this is the beginnings of him starting it. Verse 2, and he found a certain Jew named Aquila, which means eagle, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had run all the Jews out of that area. And he came to them in the last part of verse 2. So because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers. It's interesting. If you studied under a rabbi, you got religious training. And one of the things that the rabbis taught you or made sure that you learned was a trade. So they wanted you to know the scriptures, and they wanted you to know how to work with your hands. Because you never knew if you were going to get a job somewhere as a scholar, because if you didn't, you could always work with your hands. So Paul here was a tent maker. What the rabbis had trained, and sometimes they would turn him over to the father and say, train him in your occupation. But a scholar wasn't a scholar unless he knew the word, and he knew how to work with his hands. So all rabbis had an occupation they could fall back on. Paul's was being a tent maker. So was Priscilla's. And he reasoned in the synagogues every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. Wait a minute. Isn't the Sabbath done away with? No, Paul was keeping it here. With the Gentiles. Notice verse 11. He continued there a year and 6 months. So for a year and 6 months, Paul is preaching on the Sabbath to Jews and Gentiles. And the rest of the time, he's a tent maker because there wasn't a church there to support him. So he had to make a living somehow. So he did it being a tent maker. Verse 5, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. But when they opposed him and blasphemed, he shook his garments and said to them, your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. So Paul became the apostle to the Gentiles. He was preaching for a year and a half in Corinth. File that information away, because I'm going to show you later on what was going on in Corinth under the question, did the disciples keep the Passover in the days of unleavened bread? So Paul was preaching and founded the church in Corinth. We'll come to that later on. Second point, what did Jesus teach about leavening? What did Jesus teach about leavening? Leavening is the ideal substance to personify sin. I mean, if you were going to take some symbol and say this represents sin, and it was a symbol that people could understand of that time and us too, what would you choose? Well, think about leavening. Think about not leavening, but yeast, which is what leavened the bread. It was everywhere. There's yeast spores floating around in this room. Some people want to be very clean. There's dirt and yeast and spores all over this room. And if you have some starter mix here, warm dough and water with a little sugar, it's going to produce spores of yeast. So yeast is everywhere. Is sin everywhere? Yeah. Yeast is very small. You don't notice it. It hides everywhere, just like sin. So the analogies between sin and leavening or yeast and sourdough, I mean, it's a perfect example. They say that if you could take your body, your cells in your body, and if you could make them disappear, that there would be a little shadow of you that is made up of bacteria and viruses and parasites and all of that, because we carry all of that in our bodies. There's yeast everywhere. So this is a perfect example of what sin is. Sin is everywhere. It starts off small. A little bit of it just messes up lots. Analogies are perfect. So what did Jesus teach about this leavening? Let's go to Matthew 16. Beginning to read in verse 5. Now mine has little headings on it, and it says, the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Let's begin to read in verse 5. Now when his disciples had come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Bread was a staple. It's not like this stuff we eat that's all fluff. You know, you had a half a loaf of bread back then, and that fed you. It was whole wheat with butter and with cream. That was a meal in itself. So they forgot to take bread. Verse 6, then Jesus said to them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The disciples were kind of dense sometimes. And you know, it reminds me of the way I was when I first learned the truth. I remember I came in, I started studying the church's literature when I was about 14. But I remember once I was about 17. And I remember I was reading on my back porch a booklet on the millennial rule of Christ. And I'd been studying it for many weeks, and it finally dawned on me, they're talking about a literal kingdom. This is not an analogy. This is a literal kingdom. I was like, huh? It took a while for me to get it. Verse 7, and they reasoned among themselves, saying, he's saying this about the leaven of the Pharisees because we haven't brought any bread. Maybe he wants us to go get bread. We're going to have to go to the market to get bread. And there's going to be the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Maybe that's a special bread. You know, he wants us to get a different kind of bread, not the bread the Pharisees and the Sadducees people sell. Maybe it's whole wheat bread. I mean, you can imagine all the gyrations, you know, when Jesus says, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Verse 8, but Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, oh, you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves because you have brought no bread? Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Don't you remember a while back I performed a miracle where I fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and there was more leftovers than when you started with? I don't need your bread. Verse 10, nor of the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? How is it that you do not understand? I did not speak to you concerning bread, but to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They had an aha moment. You ever had those aha moments? I see it now. They had an aha moment. Verse 12. Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees and Sadducees had a certain sin that was rampant among them. And Jesus was telling them, you beware of this doctrine. Let's go to Matthew 23, forward 4 or 5 pages. We're going to see this doctrine here. Matthew 23. And when you read Matthew 23, you come to understand what the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees was. It was hypocrisy and iniquity. The word hypocrisy, the Greek word, means actor. You act one way here, you act another way there. That's what hypocrisy is. If you're a hypocrite, you're acting, you're putting on a show. When I'm being a hypocrite, when you're being a hypocrite, we're putting on a show. And Jesus says that that's one of the sins, major sins, of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They were hypocritical. Let's read in Matthew 23, verse 14. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, actors, for you devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. You know, you buy widows' houses because they need the money, and then you run them out of their house and sell the house for a profit, and yet you have long prayers. Therefore, you will receive greater condemnation. Verse 15, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much the son of hell as yourself. You'll go to great lengths to preach to people and to get them to convert, and when they're converted, they're twice as bad as you are. Verse 16, woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. It doesn't matter whether you swear by the temple or the gold. Don't nitpick about it. The result is the same. Verse 17, fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? Verse 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe and mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. All right. We don't have to tithe. You see, we need to have love and mercy. Those are the most important things. Forget about tithing. What the Pharisees did is they had mint leaves. You ever seen mint leaves? They're about this big. They're on a little stalk with lots of little leaves. And they would go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 for me, 1 for God. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 for me, 1 for God. They did it with anise seeds. They're about the size of a grain of sand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 One for God. With cumin or cominos. Little comino seeds like this. Oh, if you grind them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 One for God. What are you doing today? I can't go with you. I'm going to be tithing on my spices. I'm not exaggerating. They did that. Notice what it says. Verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. You know, how righteous would you look if you said, oh, I can't go today with you. I'm going to be tithing on my spices and the things in my house. Boy, he's very righteous. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin or comino and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the other undone. In other words, you should be more merciful, you should be more just, and you still need to tithe on your mint and anise. Don't leave that undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. And it's like people, this is what the Pharisees did. They would take their pudding, or they would take their yogurt, or they would take their cheese, or their wine that was fermenting it, and they wouldn't let bugs get in there because you can't swallow a bug. And so they would cheesecloth over it. So it would strain out the gnats. And then, after they ate those clean foods, because they didn't have any gnat parts in it, they would swallow a camel, symbolically, because they did all kinds of sinful things. You know, the government allows you to have certain amount of bug parts in your food. The Pharisees would have had a big problem with that. They'd be right now trying to clean everything. And they would strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Verse 25, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Verse 27, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inwardly are full of dead man's bones and all uncleanliness. The synagogue, each synagogue had, for a better word, service organizations. All right? And the service organization, some of them would go help the widows, some of them would go rebuild the, you know, parts of the temple that need to be rebuilt. One of the organizations they had was the tomb painters. They would go and they would whitewash the tombs. Now, you ever been driving on the side of the road and you see a cross on the side of the road? Somebody's run off the road and gotten killed there? Well, imagine you live back in this time and people were on a trip and they died. I mean, you just pulled over, got off your horse or quit walking, pulled over, dug a hole, put them in there, and covered them over with rocks. There's a dead person there. So what the Pharisees would do is right before the days of unleavened bread would come, they would go and they would find all these tombs, you know, these graves on the side of the road, and they would whitewash them. And they would whitewash the tombs that were, you know, in the city. And you would say, oh, that's because they wanted to make the land look pretty and wanted to clean up things. Partly, but the other reason was, you see, you didn't want to be on a trip and you pull over to eat your cheese and your bread and you sit down on a pile of rocks and find out that there's a body underneath, because then you were defiled and you couldn't eat the Passover. So the Pharisees whitewashed these tombs so people would defile themselves. That's what it's talking about. And you know what? They would whitewash the tomb of the prophets that had been killed. You know who killed the prophets? Their ancestors killed the prophets. That's what it's talking about here in verse 29. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous. And say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. We'd have been around. We wouldn't have killed Jesus. Verse 31, therefore you are witnesses against yourself that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Part of the leavening of the Pharisees was they were hypocrites. And these are examples of Christ talking to the Pharisees. Christ was very, very merciful with sinners. He was very, very hard and harsh with self-righteous people who claimed to have no sin. And this is why he goes on this tirade against them. He calls them later on a bunch of snakes, brood of vipers, bunch of snakes. So this is what Jesus taught about the leavening of the Pharisees. The biggest problem with the Pharisees was their hypocrisy. And was they were not sincere. The Greek word for sincere means without wax. Spanish, sin, sere, wax. What they would do is you would have a vase, or a vase, depending on whether you're from this country or another, but you would have a vase, and the vase had a crack in it, and you were the vase salesman. So they would put wax on it, and then they would polish it up so the crack was hidden. And then you would go home and put beans in this or rice to cook, and it would break. You didn't want to buy a vase that had wax. You wanted to buy one without wax. So when you got one without wax, sincere, it was what you got. It was exactly as it appeared. We need to be, and I need to be, more sincere in our life. But that was the greatest problem with the Pharisees: sincerity and hypocrisy. Now, the hypocrisy of the Pharisees is alive and well today. Would you recognize 11 of the Pharisees if you saw one today? Notice Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. On these days of unleavened bread, especially this first day of unleavened bread, sin is represented by leaven. It's good to see what Jesus taught about this subject. Luke chapter 12. 12. And in verse 1. In the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together so that they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that will not be revealed, nor hidden that will not be known. Therefore, whatever you have spoken in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you have spoken in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed on the housetops. The Pharisees were hypocrites. Notice Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22. The lesson for us, brethren, is obvious. We should not be like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. We shouldn't be acting. We should be sincere. What you see is what you get. That's the way we should be. And how should we be? Keep the commandments, holiness, righteousness, other subjects for other sermons. Matthew chapter 22. Verse 15. Then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. They didn't want to know if it was really true. Are you really the Messiah? Are you speaking the truth? No, we want to entangle you so we can trip you up, so that we can turn you over and you can be put away. Verse 16, and they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians. The Herodians in ancient Greece were known as orators, speakers, trained speakers in logic and all of these other philosophical sciences. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. They were buttering him up. Therefore, tell us, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, Why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. Tax money in that time was a coin. As money is today, it had a picture of some important politician on one side. Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, Whose image and inscription is this? He's pointing to the coin. And they said to him, Caesar's. Therefore, God said to them, Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. When they heard this, they marveled and left him, and went their way. Give to God what is his, and give to man what is his. That's what he was telling them. But notice, bottom of verse 18, they were hypocrites. Let me give you an up-to-date example of hypocrisy. You might have gone to the store to buy ingredients or to look at bread products. And you say, let me check these items and let me check the ingredients and let me see if there's any leavening in them. Because we're not supposed to have leavening in our house. Now, there's a large Jewish food producer, manufactures matzos and all kinds of ingredients. And if you've ever gone to the store and you tried to buy unleavened matzos, you'll notice that some of them are not unleavened. But yet, the definition of matzos is unleavened. And it says on it, even though they're leavened, fine for the Passover. How is that possible? This is some examples that I found when I went to the grocery store. Carrot cake for the Passover. This is the ingredients: sugar, brown sugar, cake meal, starch, vegetable oil, shortening, sodium bicarbonate. Yellow cake mix. You want to make a nice yellow cake for the Passover? Here's what's in the ingredients: sugar, cake meal, potato starch, vegetable shortening, cocoa butter, a couple of things I can't pronounce, salt, sodium acid, sodium bicarbonate. But all labeled fit for the Passover. You might ask, how is all of this possible? Let me read you out of the Wikipedia article under the Passover term. Shemitz, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, is the Hebrew word for leavening. Shemitz, leavening, is something that is both made from one of five types of grains and has been combined with water and left to stand raw for longer than 18 minutes. The consumption, keeping, and owning of shemitz is forbidden during the Passover. Shemitz does not include baking soda, baking powders, or like products, although these are defined in English as leavening agents. They leaven by chemical reaction, not by biological fermentation. Thus, bagels, waffles, and pancakes made with baking soda and matzos are considered permissible, while bagels made with sourdough and pancakes and waffles made with yeast are prohibited. So, they turn a blind eye to the leavening. The perfect example of being hypocritical and of putting your thoughts and ideas before God's. Let's go to Mark chapter 7. Mark chapter 7. You ever been out working on your car? Cutting the yard? Sewing some clothes? And your spouse? I'm making this it can go either way. And your spouse brings you a sandwich? Oh, and a glass of tea? What do you do? Well, I tell you what I do. I eat it. Drink the glass of tea. Verse 1 of Mark 7. Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands, they found fault. If you would have gotten that, now I'm not talking about you have a lot of grease on your hand and you've been working in manure. I'm not talking about that. Obviously, you have to wash your hands. But if your hands are clean, like right now, I have no problems eating a cookie with my hands the way they are. Unleavened. No problem. But it says here, verse 3, for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way. Now, the Pharisees were trying to imitate the priests in the temple. And the priests in the temple, when they handled things, it talked about bathing the body and all that. Some of the Pharisees would not eat unless they took a bath. And they got their hands nice and clean. Imagine a surgeon, looking for something clean to dry your hands on. That's the way the Pharisees were when it came to eating. They accused Jesus of his disciples not doing that. Verse 4, when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they have received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and couches. You're at home. Somebody's sitting on your couch. They leave. You don't sit there till it's been cleaned. Because their tush touched the couch, and you don't want to sit on top of where they've been. So they actually cleaned the couches before they could sit on them. Verse 5, then the Pharisees and Sadducees asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? He answered and said to them, I'd like to ask you a question. He made a statement. Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites? What was the problem? Hypocrisy. I want to be clean, and I want to appear to be clean, and I want to go through this whole rigmarole of washing my hands so I can look like I'm clean, and I have all kinds of things wrong with me. The people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. For laying aside the commandment of God, think about those bread products, for laying aside the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men. The tradition of men says it's okay to eat them if it's made out of sodium bicarbonate. The Bible didn't say that. The washing of pitchers, cups, and many other such things you do. He said to them, all too well, you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your own tradition. Still alive and well, brethren, in hand washing. So what does that mean for us today as we are here on this last day of unleavened bread? I hope you've gotten it by now, and that is, we must not be like the Pharisees. We must not be like the Sadducees. We must not be hypocrites. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. You remember I told you to hold that thought about Paul being the one that started the Corinthian church and working for a year and a half there? This is a message to the church that he started. We talked about, does the New Testament church keep the holy days? Do they keep the Passover? Do they keep the days of unleavened bread? 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 6. Your glorying is not good. We're so righteous in this church that if people do the wrong things, we're not going to judge them. We're just going to let them do what they want. That's not what the Bible says. Now, you should be merciful when you deal with people that are in sin. And I'm speaking to the choir here, brethren. But sin has to be dealt with, not only in the church, but in your life. Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little bit of leaven leavens a whole lump? They just took a little bit over here, and they leavened it over here. That would be like me asking you, don't you know that water comes from a faucet? If I said, you know water comes from a faucet, you'd all go, it does, yes. Well, these people all knew that a little leaven leavened the whole lump, because they did that every day when they made bread. A little bit of sin, brethren, in your life and my life is going to puff you up and leaven you and make you full of sin. Therefore, verse 7, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you truly are a leaven. For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Couple of things here. This was a church in Corinth that many, many years after Christ had died, was keeping the feast of unleavened bread. How do we know that? Because it says, therefore, let us keep the feast. Now, what feast is associated with Christ being the Passover and you eating unleavened bread? It's a no-brainer for us. You know why? Because we're keeping them. People in the world don't see this because they're not keeping them. And they don't have the Holy Spirit. Another thing. If I told you, if I asked you, are you physically unleavened? You'd say, oh yeah, I'm physically unleavened. I took my car and I vacuumed it out. And I even moved the seats forward and backwards to vacuum out, you know, where I dropped all the breadcrumbs and the hamburger particles from the hamburger buns. And my wife cleaned out underneath the in the stove, and we cleaned out the toaster. Yes, I'm unleavened. Now, I didn't ask you if you were spiritually unleavened. I asked you if you were physically unleavened. Notice what it says here, verse 7. Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. The church he was talking to was physically unleavened because they had put all leaven out of their house. So this is saying a few things here that we need to notice. One is, a little bit of leaven, leaven's a whole lump. Christ, the Passover, had just been sacrificed. They had kept the Passover previously. They were in the middle of keeping the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and they were physically unleavened. They were keeping the days of unleavened bread. That goes in another section we talked about. But also, what I want you to notice is that a little bit of sin leavens the whole lump. A little bit of sin in your life, you start compromising, brethren. You start making excuses. I start making excuses. Pretty soon you're wondering, how did I get here? A little leaven leavens the whole lump. What should we be doing? We should be living like Christ. When we took that Passover bread, the minister probably read to you that the Passover bread symbolizes Christ living in you. You can't have a loaf that's part leaven and part unleavened, because the leavening is going to make the whole loaf leaven. You got to have it either unleavened or leavened. It's not there's no in between. There's no hybrid loaves. So you and I, brethren, we must be unleavened. We need to get rid of the leaven that is in our life. Couple of more scriptures. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5. Examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus is in you? Jesus Christ, when we took that piece of unleavened bread, we were symbolically putting Christ into our life. I mean, we're dealing with physical human beings, brethren. We got to do some physical things to get those lessons learned. And that's why we were doing that. That's why we do the things that we do in a physical sense. It's teaching us spiritual lessons. And right here it says that Christ is living in us. Christ used unleavened bread at the Passover. And when the disciples prepared the Passover, the lamb, and they roasted it, and they prepared it with unleavened bread. And you remember where it says, after supper being ended, he took the towel and he started washing the feet. The supper that had ended was Old Testament Passover, where they ate the lamb with the bitter herbs and the unleavened bread. And so the bread he broke to symbolize himself, and the wine he used later, the bread he broke was unleavened, because that's what they were eating that night. So Jesus Christ is unleavened bread. Is unleavened bread. How about sin? Let's look at final scripture. Hebrews. We're in the middle, or in the beginning of the days of unleavened bread. Hebrews chapter 12, brethren. God has told us for the next 7 days to eat unleavened bread. To put leavening out of our homes. He's teaching us a lesson, brethren. He's teaching us that we need to get sin out of our lives. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1. Think about yeast and how it's everywhere. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, that's the people back in the preceding chapter, chapter 11, faith chapter. Cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. Little rabbits running down the trail. The snare is popped. The rabbit is dangling from a sapling 10 feet off the ground with a wire noose around his neck. Ensnared. That's the way sin is. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. The physical task of unleavening our homes and our cars and our possessions reminds us of the more important spiritual principle that we, you and I, need to unleaven our lives. We need to unleaven our lives. Our keeping of the feast of unleavened bread forces us to realize that we need the help of God and His Spirit. You remember Jesus, what He said? Probably had it read to you a few hours ago, the Passover, when He said, I'm not going to leave you orphans. I'm going to send the Helper, which is the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is going to guide you in all things. We have a Spirit. God wanted to help us so much that He gave us His Son as a sacrificial Passover lamb. He continues to help us by living and dwelling in us, as symbolized by us taking that piece of unleavened bread, which symbolizes His body and His blood, and ingesting it and eating it. You know, the disciples, when He mentioned this a short time before the Passover, when He said, you know, you must eat My body and drink My blood, they thought He was talking about cannibalism. This is a hard saying. When you and I participate in the Passover, we're intaking the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. In other words, Jesus is living in us. We're unleavened. We should be unleavened. Jesus continues to help us by living and dwelling in us, which makes it possible for us to repent and to continue on towards eternal life.